Hey, Jeff here.
Craig here.
Just before we kick in today's episode, we're going to take a little moment to tell you about our friends over at Glee Coffee. They are an Australian-owned coffee roaster, Craig, that have just dropped their new spring range.
Oh, yes. You got to love spring, guys.
Oh, spring has sprung, and so they've dropped a new range. They actually have the Spring Break Super Blend in there, Craig.
Oh, yeah, and it doesn't have Cancun anywhere in sight. Or douchebags.
Right. No Channing Tatums. No Jonah Hills in sight. But I reckon if they tasted a little bit of the spring break, they would be mightily impressed.
Oh, yes. Mightily.
They've also got a Costa Rican single origin in there. It tastes a bit apricot-y. A little bit of honey in there as well. So a little fruit and sweetness to brighten up your day.
You don't want your coffee too bitter. Not like my marriage.
I love it so much. Oh, well, see as though things got a little dark, let's head to a nice hearty roast.
Ooh.
Straight from Kenya. It's got a little bit of a grapefruity taste, but it is so nice.
Oh, yeah, beautiful.
Beautiful. Last but not least, there's also an Ethiopian in there as well. That's a nice hint of mango all through that.
Oh, mango, man. My son will love it.
I know, it doesn't. Mango's just got this like springish, summery vibe going on. It's fruity. We love it.
Exactly. And it's coffee. It's caffeine.
That's exactly right, Craig. So where can people get their hands on some of this sweet, sweet caffeinated goodness?
Guys, go onto the website www.gleecoffee.com.au/store. Go crazy. Go wild, okay? Because you know why you can go wild? Is because when you're about to check out, go to the discount code, add in FFTL, that stands for from first to last, and you'll get 15% off, which means you can buy more.
Yes. Discounts equal more play money for you.
Damn right. Like, more coffee money for you.
More That's right. Get some more coffee. You know what? Upgrade from the 500 gram to the kilo bag.
Damn right.
Go crazy.
Think about how effective you're going to be. All brilliant.
That's right.
It's all money making. All money making.
Make a change in this world. Buy some coffee. So let's kick into today's episode without any waiting, Craig.
Let's get into it.
Hey, I'm Jeff Reed.
I'm Craig Killian.
And this is the From First to Last podcast. This is a From First to Last podcast. It's a podcast where my friend Craig and I, we get together each week and we work our way through a director's theatrical filmography from their first film all the way through to their last. And Craig, we are getting towards the back end of season 7.
We are.
Who are we talking season 7?
Well, the French would say he's Michel Lemond. Actually, they wouldn't fucking say that. They'd say Michael Mann. But yeah, Michael Mann.
What a season it's been too, Craig.
Oh, man, fantastic season, mate. Fantastic. We say that about most seasons. But it is. Each season we learn something new. Each season our horizons are broadened.
I love it. And if there's one takeaway this season so far, Craig, just putting you on the spot, we've not planned this in any way, shape or form. If there's one
takeaway. Do we plan much? We plan mostly on air.
That's very true. What's a takeaway that you've got from this season?
I've said it a couple of times, well, probably more than a couple of times, that he's more than a one-trick pony. I know that's a silly thing to say, and there are Michael Mann fanatics out there going, he's never been a one-trick pony. But look, hey, guys, I come from this not from an educated film school.
Yeah.
Or film perspective. I just came here from an audience member, and I've always looked at Michael Mann as the dude with the guns.
Yeah, it's interesting because we saw him as the heist thriller director.
Heist, yeah, criminal dude, criminal thriller dude.
Yeah, and we're really realizing that while he does have a few films that work around crime as
such. That's his wheelhouse.
But what we're really discovering is that Michael Mann is a very versatile director who loves a good character study.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Eddie actually plays, and then I totally forget, and obviously this is the reason we do the podcast, is I forget how different some of his films are. Like, I totally forgot Last of the Mohicans, man. You know, yeah. You just go, oh, geez, I didn't even remember, like, you know, and these random films that he's popped up, obviously we can go back to The Keep like we always do, but just these different genres that he's played around with, superb. Yeah.
It's crazy. Whilst all still feeling like they're made by Michael Mann.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Still Mann-ish.
Yeah, well, I guess Joe Carnahan's someone that's sort of popped up a few times this season. And
he has.
You can't sort of watch Michael Mann's film without seeing some tendrils sort of man in Joe Carnahan's work. But when we followed his season, and we'll talk a bit more Joe Carnahan later in the episode, but a film like The Grey is sort of so out of the box, but still feels like Carnahan in a way.
I think, and I, like I said, we'll probably go into this more in the episode, but I think Carnahan and Mann approach masculinity the same way.
Yeah, love it, Craig.
And so they approach, obviously, the toxic part, and they also approach the, I guess, the stereotypes of masculinity throughout their career. Good. Obviously, Michael Mann does it better with, I guess, more finesse than Carnahan.
Yeah.
But I think they both have the same ideals when it comes to manhood and masculinity, really. Yeah. Masculinity.
Love it. Love it, Craig. Last week, Craig, we had an absolute ball of a time.
We did.
We were joined by some friends, Lee and Tim from the Popcorn Podcast.
Oh, man. They were awesome. Hey.
They were.
Seriously, our guests this year have been on target. Better than that bloody John Rourke guy. But better than Jono. Jeez.
No, I thought you were going to say John Killian.
You know, Jono can sit at my feet anytime. But yeah, it's amazing to have like people like Maria, Blake, Tim and Lee, who are just such avid. They're not just movie critics, they're fans as well. That's what I've loved about each and every one of them. The fact that, you know, they're not on here talking about the French New Wave and blah, 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 whatever.
Yeah.
They're here talking about, man, I just love that film, man. That was great. I just watched it, this, and this. And you just go, yeah, dude. They're the guys who just have that same rush when the lights go out in the theater.
Yeah, they get it, don't they?
They get it.
I love it. And so
we all get it. Yeah, everyone who listens to this gets it.
Yeah.
These are all the bros, man.
Yeah.
All bros.
We love you. We love you all.
Whatever pronoun you take.
Too true, Craig. Now, we talked Ali, and again, this is film that really, for me, Mann is there. It's also a film that has a deep connection visually to Collateral.
Yep.
And you can see the steps Mann's taking to his future films. Like, if we were to think, Ali stepping up to Collateral, then stepping into Miami Vice, you can see the visual steps that he's taking.
You can see the digital kick in.
Yeah, totally.
So and that first, what is it, the first 5 minutes of the film?
Yep.
Of Ali.
Yep. It's so it's digital.
Basically all of Collateral.
And it's really funny. He talks about the digital technology that they used in Collateral. I found a really interesting interview with Michael Mann. And he basically says, for all those tens of thousands of dollars worth of gear that we used to make Collateral in high definition digital, most people can get them for about $200 at any chemist nowadays with the same quality of technology.
Wow. That's hardcore. That's hardcore.
So it's pretty crazy. But we had a great time talking, Ali. We also really, really enjoyed the film. It was one of those ones where we could see faults in it. It was by no means a perfect film.
Mm.
But it was a film that had such great conversation around it. And I really enjoyed it for that.
So, and Tim and Lee brought some fantastic concepts to the table.
Yeah, didn't they?
And I think they spiced up the conversation a little bit more. Like, we obviously, yes, if you do listen back, it does look like I don't think we hammered it. We, like you said, we found some faults with it.
Yeah.
But all in all, you know, a bad Michael Mann film is better than 80% of other films out there.
That's right. But it is one of those things when you are frequently getting quality, the moment the quality deviates slightly, suddenly you go, oh, whoa. You know, like if we were eating in a 5-star restaurant all the time and then suddenly they drop a 4-star meal, you're so surprised that you can't stop talking about that 4-star meal. And I think that's probably where I land with Ali in relation to Michael Mann's filmography. Thankfully, I'm saying it right now, Craig, that's not how I feel about this week's film.
Oh, no.
What an absolute cracker. And I'm so excited because this week we are giving you another two-parter.
Yeah, because we're just stretching shit out. We're stretching our franchises now. This is the last episode of our franchises, and so we're just splitting them out, guys. We're splitting them out.
We're trying
to get more money off you, you know, make those podcasts dollars.
That's right. If we keep getting you here in our stuff, you'll buy Glee Coffee and get that.
Damn
sweet,
right, man, because we're rolling in coffee beans, man. Rolling.
There is a reason.
Whoever controls the coffee controls the women.
There is a reason for the two-part episode, and that's because we are so stoked. We were this week to have Stuart Beatty on the podcast to talk about Collateral. Now, for those who don't know, Stuart Beatty is the writer of the film. He's an Australian writer, producer, director. We sat down last week and had a chat with Stuart, and afterwards Craig and I were both like, oh my gosh, this is so good. We can't just chop this apart and splice it in with our episode.
I was so fucking nervous when I first started it. I think my first words, you go out on a date and you come home and you think, oh my God, I can't believe I fucking said that. My first time I spoke, I just talked dribble. I don't even remember what I know it was just dribble. It was just dribble. It was just limp dick dribble, and it was just so horrible.
It's funny because
I got warmed up.
Afterwards, as I sort of processed, and I just got straight into life straight afterwards, so I didn't have a lot of time to process. But later on,
I went straight to the beach afterwards.
There's a moment where I know I clearly just gushed about how well written this film was, and I just can remember Stuart's face being like, this is nice, but it's going too long.
This is crazy.
But it was an incredible chat. You guys are going to love it. Stuart is so open. He talks about the journey to screen.
Hell yes, is he open and what, man? Oh.
And he talks about projects such as the unrealized Halo movie /TV series. He talks about politics within the film
Hollywood
industry.
Politics. We're not talking Trump and shit. We're talking Hollywood politics.
He talks about what it's like for a screenwriter and how they can get credit sometimes, how can they can sometimes not get credit. It's such a great chat. So we just couldn't starve you of pieces of that because it's so great. So you'll get a full Collateral episode. We're not cutting halfway through and giving you the rest. But next week, you'll get to hear Stuart's full interview with us. And it's something special. We had such a great time, didn't we, Craig?
Yeah, exactly. And hopefully we can have him on again because he's such a wealth of knowledge. Like, it's just awesome. It's awesome to break down, like a breakdown of scenes and stuff like that. Yeah, seriously, man. I loved it so much.
For two film nerds, it was absolute nirvana. So we just loved it, didn't we, Craig?
Mm.
So, Craig, after all that great stuff, should we get in this week's episode?
Let's crack in.
So we've had 3 years or just under 3 years between the release of Ali and the release of Collateral. Now, as people heard last week, the turnaround time between his previous project and Ali, which I'm just having an absolute mental blank, what came after. Oh, The Insider to Ali was the shortest turnaround that we had. And we did discuss that potentially that played a part in the quality of writing that we got throughout the film. It just wasn't as realized and developed as we'd sort of hoped it might be. And
I think it's not the writing so much as it's just a weird point in his life.
Yeah.
That was my major issue. My major issue was that this is the perfect season two of a three season about Ali's life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just, I needed more.
Yeah, I totally get it, Craig. I totally get it. So we've had just under 3 years between Ali and Collateral. And the next few years are actually, it's pretty crucial for Mann as a filmmaker, because it really is, we've stepped into the season where he is fully embracing digital filmmaking. And so as we talked about before, we're starting to see these stepping stones of Mann starting to dabble a little bit. He's trialing it a bit more, and now Collateral has quite a portion. I think off the top of my head, it might have been something like 60 to 80% of the film is digital now.
Yeah.
So it really jumps wholeheartedly in there. What also has happened is 2002, which is the year after Ali's release, sees Michael Mann return to TV as well.
Ooh.
So he's really working quite a lot. As we've learned, he is very, very busy. So he returns to TV as executive producer for a TV show called Robbery Homicide Division. Now, the television show starred Tom Sizemore, and it was a gritty look at detectives within the LAPD, and basically they're trying to solve the worst crimes that LA sees. So it's really gritty, really hard hitting, this TV show. And during the film, Mann actually saw it as the perfect opportunity to experiment with digital cameras. So he's making this TV show all on digital so he can really hone the skills to use it for his films. So Robbery Homicide Division was actually likened to a TV version of Heat, and was often given quite good reviews and also really decent ratings on CBS. But unfortunately, despite their decent ratings, CBS puts the show on hiatus after only 10 episodes.
Have you ever seen an episode?
No, I haven't. Hey, how about you?
I'm surprised I hadn't, because I was like big Tom Sizemore fan.
Yeah, well, there's a bit of stuff in the background that plays a huge part into why this TV show isn't doing well.
Is it Tom Sizemore?
It is Tom Sizemore, Craig. It is, unfortunately.
Hey, look, at least he doesn't surprise you.
The TV show was actually pulling better ratings than Law & Order, SVU.
Duh-duh.
And so, like, that's a big syndicate show, so it's the fact that it's getting more people watching than that, it's a big deal. And so Mann and co, with the show on hiatus, tried to find a new home, and they actually go to HBO and Showtime, but unfortunately they couldn't find a permanent home for the show. At the same time, rumors started floating around that the reason, even though it wasn't given publicly, that CBS pulled the show was because Tom Sizemore had an arrest for drug charges. And sadly, the incident and the cancellation of the show took a toll on just more than Sizemore's career. Now, from there, Sizemore was a very big up-and-coming, not up-and-coming actor, but an actor who people could really see as a talent.
He was that, I guess he had that Ray Liotta type.
Yeah.
Type intensity. He was one of those really intense actors of the time, you know, like your Nick Nolte's and all those type of guys, you know, those ones who just oozed intensity, like they could fucking snap at any moment.
Yeah.
And he was just coming big. He was just that guy he was in so many films at the time as the guy who could snap.
Yeah, totally. And so sadly, the incident takes its toll on Sizemore and his career. And years later, Sizemore actually sits back and reflects on that period of his life. And he actually reflects with quite a lot of remorse for his behavior and the way it all plays out. And he talks about how sad he is in the fact that it affected the crew and the other cast in such a way, because there were all these people believing they had this hit show that's going to really be setting them up for a lifetime opportunity in television. unfortunately as well, Sizemore reflects on it and talks about the fact that it actually ended up causing a falling out between he and Michael Mann. And at this point in his career, Mann was quite an important figure in Sizemore's life, so much he actually considered him his mentor and one of the main reasons he became such a great actor. And what's even sadder, Craig, is at the time that he talked about that, it still hadn't been resolved. So the falling out just was massive for him.
Oh, well, you can imagine, because I guess there were any time when it was running on CBS, his head.
Yeah.
Where the executive would have gone, look, you need to replace him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think it seems like Michael Mann stuck by his man.
Yes.
Even as he shopped him out. Even knowing that, you know, obviously this was what would tank it. You know what I mean? Like, and this is probably the reason that a lot of places wouldn't have picked it up. Netflix probably would have picked it up now. But they wouldn't, you know, Sizemore was just a, you know, well, he was, and he still is. He's just a fucking, a bad publicity waiting to happen, which is very tragic. You know what I mean? Like, the man is dealing with a lot of shit, and you can tell he's a very much of an addict.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's pretty hard.
It's sad to see, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. It is. But, you know, all too common.
Yeah, totally. So during this time, from Ali onwards, it's a bit of a heck of a journey for the film Collateral. Now, Mann is developing it, and as we're going to hear, the writer Stuart Beatty had been pitching it and trying to get this film made for a heck of a long time before even any of this stuff had started. But before we really dig deep into the film's journey to screen, Craig, let's just take a little moment and have a quick refresher. For those people who've seen the film Collateral, or for those people who've never seen the film at all, let's just take a moment and let's just hear about it.
Within the vivid nightlife of Los Angeles, a world-weary cab driver finds himself the hostage of a deadly contract killer as he makes his round from hit to hit, killing witnesses for a drug cartel. Michael Mann brings LA to life again for this edgy your seat thriller. Let's talk about Collateral.
So good, Craig. Collateral was released August 6, 2004 and took a whopping $220 million worldwide at the box office.
Hot damn! Yes. What was the budget?
Budget of $65 million.
Hot damn!
So in terms of Michael Mann, this is a low-budget film.
Michael Mann was like, his name was a actual sales point at this time.
Oh, very much so. And if you think to go Heat, The Insider, Ali, they are three films that had some form of Oscar buzz around them.
If he would have kept at this peak, he would. We wouldn't be doing a season on him.
That's 100%, Craig. He would be, yep. Yeah,
it's, he would still it's so be true. Very, very high up on the, on, you know, even though he still is, but yep. He's not, he would have become like a household name by now.
Yeah, totally. And it's actually probably a bit sad because if he'd backed up The Insider perhaps with Collateral, I think his trajectory might have continued going because, I'm really surprised with this film. I'll say it early on, but I'm really surprised with this film that more people don't list it as one of the great thrillers. It's just it's just nonstop, but we'll get there soon. So the film itself received very positive reviews and really shows that despite the more modest budget for Mann, that a tight film could be made. And this is, I think, what works so well is how contained this film is. But we'll get there later in the episode, Craig. So before we dive into the film's journey to screen, let's take a look at the cinematic landscape for 2004.
2004?
I know, 2004. It's a year that's actually been described by a lot of film and analyzers, you know, those people who really look a bit deeper at how the year played out. It's been described as a banner year for actors, particularly male actors.
Now, wow, I'm 24 at this time.
Oh, whoa. What would I be then? Man, I'm 21?
20? 21 year roundabout, yeah.
So it's a year that's been described as been a year. And when we really get into it, we'll see that it features a lot of biopics, a lot more than normal. It's sort of, this is the year where there are lots of lead actors really putting in big performances for big films. So let's take a look at what the worldwide box office was like. And on top of those biopics as well, Craig, there's also a lot of massive, and I mean massive, franchises operating at the time. So the number one film for 2004 is Shrek 2 with $926 million.
Damn.
That's right.
Shrek 2.
Shrek 2 is the one where Shrek and Fiona are married.
Yeah.
And
they see the parents?
And they go visit the parents. And it's actually...
That's right.
It's a really fun one, actually.
It is. It is. They're very fun until Justin Timberlake ruined it.
I think the third one's where the wheels fall off a bit, and that's where it just feels like a whole heap of funny situations that they try to piece together to make a movie, as opposed to...
That's where they all just... storyline. Fulfill their contract.
100%.
Obligations.
The number two film for 2004, Craig, is my favourite Harry Potter film with Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
It is a fantastic film.
So
You haven't seen anyone as dark as that.
No.
Like, don't get me wrong, I don't think he could have gone through the rest of the series. I think David Yates was a perfect combination.
Definitely.
But for Prisoner, amazing, man.
And it really... Prisoner needed to be that dark because it needed to take them from little kids to angsty teens to then be adults. Yet they needed to show that window where they're sort of adults, sort of not adults, to really get there. And a funny little running joke that's been happening with the staff at my work is, as we've watched lockdown happen and our hair all grow, the statement has been made that Jeff is at his Prisoner of Azkaban phase and he's on his way to his Goblet of Fire phase as his hair gets longer and longer through lockdown.
I was going to say, man, you're looking pretty fucking scrappy-doo.
I've got a lot of hair, Craig.
You're like a bad sleep away from being homeless. You're just a fucking... All you need is just some crazy shit. You just need a little bit... You need to get rid of those kind eyes, Jeff. You'd be fucking crazy as shit. It'd be awesome.
I need to go through some hard stuff so I can be Rutger Hauer. the number three film we've actually talked about on this podcast before, Craig, it's Spider-Man 2 from Sam Raimi.
Fantastic. Hello, so, Peter.
Yeah.
Yes, I can't wait for it.
I can't wait either. Number four was Pixar's The Incredibles.
That was incredible. Yeah. I love that movie, man. It was one, I remember when it first came out, I was just like, man, this is going to be shit. But I loved it. I loved it.
It's that first film that when you heard about it, you were like, there's no way that Pixar can make a good movie out of that. And then they were like, no, wrong. I can make something really great. And I feel like every Pixar film since, I hear the premise and I'm like, nope, that's not going to be good. And then you watch up and like it's one of the most emotional films you could ever watch. And it's about an old man flying his house with balloons.
Yeah, exactly. You always go, this is going to be shit. But no, it's fantastic.
Number five, The Passion of the Christ.
Oh, man, seriously. I can barely watch it. But fantastic. Like, I'd say it because it's just wrenching, man.
Yep.
Just heart-wrenching, hey.
It is.
I just can't. It's just too much, man.
It's visceral.
Too much.
It's so visceral that you just can't. You can't watch a human being having that done. Whether you believe in it or not, to think of a human going through that is just, like, insane. Absolutely insane.
Exactly.
Talking about another film that... Yeah, thinking about another human.
Korean
going
Jesus
through.
Went through more.
Korean Jesus. He's busy doing
He went
Korean
through more,
things.
Man, because he did what the Jewish did, but he's Korean.
Love Korean Jesus.
Yeah, he still had to go back to work in his parents' restaurant.
Terrible. The number six film, Craig, is The Day After Tomorrow with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Oh, yep. Jakey Jill.
Number seven, Meet the Fockers.
Yep.
Number eight,
all right.
Brad Pitt. Eric Banner, Orlando Bloom, Troy.
Man, I still love that movie. As homoerotic as it is, I fucking love every moment of that movie.
It's so good.
Just Oh, but it's meant to be Greek gods.
Yeah.
Like literally, like, you know, it's meant to be a myth, and it is a myth on screen using these friggin' fantastically carved, beautiful people to actually fight. And it's, and you know, there's not a calorie in sight.
I love it so much. Number 9, Shark Tale, DreamWorks Animation. You've got Will Smith. You've
jumped
got
on
Jack
late, but
Black.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah,
the car
bad.
Wash.
Number 10, my favorite installment of the Oceans trilogy, Oceans 12.
I can't remember.
It's the one with Vincent Cassell. They go to Venice and he's the cat burglar. It's so good, Craig. It's one people, general film punters didn't enjoy it because it's Steven Soderbergh doing his version of a French film and or a European flair. But I think it's so charming and so fun. I love that movie so, so much.
Vincent Cassell, man, when he was younger, he would have made a great Lestat for Interview with a Vampire.
Oof. So true.
There's
Craig.
Actually a TV series coming up on it and an Australian guy, Sam Harris, I'm thinking might be the singer, but a guy named Sam from Australia has actually got the main role.
Oh, go Sam. Well done.
Good on you, Sam.
I love it. So, Craig, Collateral is actually the fourth film from 2004 that we've covered on From First to Last. As we mentioned before, we talked Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 2, but in addition to Spidey, we actually talked Robert Zemeckis' Polar Express.
Yep.
With that sweet,
my son still loves that.
Sweet CGI eyeballs. And
we'll be busting that out fairly soon.
Yeah, we will too, in 3D, as we do every year. And we also talk Zack Snyder's directorial debut, Dawn of the Dead.
Fantastic.
Yeah,
fantastic.
It is. Fantastic debut. Now, Craig, the very franchise popcorn-y nature of the top 10 films really is flipped on its head then when you hear what else was released. Now, released this year was Martin Scorsese's The Aviator, starring Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh.
Now, what's crazy is this is a film that Michael Mann originally was developing and he stepped aside to do another project and passing it on and staying on as a producer for the film with Martin Scorsese directed. The film was nominated for 11 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, Best Actor for DiCaprio, and it won 5, including Best Supporting Actress for Cate Blanchett, Best Cinematography, Best Editing, Best Costume Design, and Best Art Direction. And I got to say, Craig, I flat out love that film.
Oh, man, seriously, it is probably top 4 of Scorsese's film, maybe even top 3.
So great.
Shit, I'd have to do a season on it.
Oh,
to figure it out. I'd have to
John's
watch through it all again.
Just counting cash at the pub.
Yeah, John's like, what? Nah, fuck it. Let's not.
We've recently, Craig and I discussed this the other day, at our house that we have been watching quite a lot of films from the 50s and the 60s. And one of them that I watched, and it's probably one of the favorite films that I've watched this year, is a film called Desk Set. And Desk Set stars Katharine Hepburn, who Cate Blanchett plays in The Aviator. And I've got to say, Cate Blanchett does an astounding Katharine Hepburn. It's so darn good in it. Also, check out Desk Set. It's really cool. It's about a newspaper who gets one of the first computers ever to do all their cataloging and research. And Katharine Hepburn leads up a team of ladies who they physically do the researching for every article that happens within the newspaper. And so it's about them dealing with being replaced by a computer and will the computer be able to cope with complex research questions. It's really good.
Oh.
Yeah, so good. Also released this year is a film that absolutely floored me in cinemas, which is the Clint Eastwood directed Million Dollar Baby.
Yeah, it did. It did. I can barely watch it.
Oh,
like it's one of those
tough
movies that hits
it?
Too hard, man.
Yeah.
It's fucking way too hard, eh?
Yeah.
I can barely watch it. I get so engrossed in that film and I just love her so much, Hilary Swank.
She's so great in it.
And
isn't
I just through the whole film, I just want to kill her family.
Yep. Totally. And the twist at the end, you just despise that female boxer that that does the dirty tactics. It's so horrible. Had 7 Oscar noms, 4 wins, Best Director for Eastwood, Best Picture, Best Actress for Swank, and Best Supporting Actor for Freeman. Clint Eastwood was also nominated for a Best Actor in that as well. Because he is
the girl who played the boxer against her. I think that was Muhammad Ali's daughter.
Oh, really?
I think so.
I like
from him. It's someone famous, a famous boxer's daughter.
Because I think Ali's daughter was in the Girl Fight documentary.
Yeah, I know she was a fighter. But hey, keep going. I'll look it up and I'll get back to you.
It's a good segue, Craig, to our next film, which was actually Ray, which scored 2 Oscar nominations based on the life of Ray Charles. Jamie Foxx won Best Actor, and when I heard that Eastwood didn't win Best Actor, I was like, who the heck beat him? And then I realised it was Jamie Foxx for his Ray Charles portrayal, and he is bonkers in this film.
He was amazing. Yeah. And that's coming from me, man. He was amazing.
And what's crazy, Craig, is Jamie Foxx was actually the second actor ever to win the Best Actor Awards across all the 5 major awards ceremonies that year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the second ever. Do you know who the first person was?
No.
Jeffrey Rush for Shine.
That makes sense. Jeffrey Rush was fantastic.
He certainly was in Shine. Also released was Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Michelle Gondry's phenomenal film.
I love that. Seriously, guys, you need to go out and watch this film.
Yep.
It was, at first, it was a bit of a mindfuck, but I think now with our culture, we can get through it and you can actually understand it more with all these, you know, multiversal crap. Get in there, man. It's so good.
Oh, it is. It's so good. Guillermo del Toro's Hellboy was released. We had
fantastic.
Edgar Wright's Shaun of the Dead was released. Yeah. Tarantino wraps up the Kill Bill saga with Kill Bill Volume 2.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We had Denzel Washington in Man on Fire. Spielberg dropped...
Man on Fire.
This film is such a grower on me, but Spielberg drops The Terminal, which Tom Hanks is so charming in that film.
Oh, you love that, don't you?
I do, Craig. I really do.
Hated it.
Here's a film I'm proud to say I've never seen, which is The Notebook.
Oh, man, I've watched that film at least 10 times. Yep.
James Wan makes his directorial debut with Saw.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Seriously, James Wan, man, he's got an Oscar in him. I fucking shit you not anyone. He's got an Oscar in him.
He's great. Will Smith had another big film that year in I, Robot. We also had Oliver Stone's Alexander.
Love that film, you know I do.
We had the really charming Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events.
Yep.
And lastly, the surprisingly good National Treasure.
Yeah, it was surprisingly good.
With Nicolas Cage.
Well, I thought that did more money.
Yeah, I think the second one took big dollars because the first one sort of like a bit of a sleeper hit.
Oh, okay, cool.
So, Craig, that's the cinematic landscape of 2004. You can see it is quite a diverse year. Lots of talented sort of drama films being dropped. A lot of popcorn films. We've got some franchises in there. Also, a couple little sneaky horrors popping up in there as well. So, this brings us to today's film, which is Collateral. And I'm so excited to get there. But as I mentioned, it's had a heck of a journey to get to the screen. One that... as you'll hear next week, wasn't just a film that was written, turned in, and a couple of years later magically got to screen. It had multiple iterations. It got changed. It got rewritten. And throughout the entire journey, Stuart Beattie, the writer, he is just consistently pitching and pitching this film and sticking with it. And I think this is, I'm going to throw it out there, Craig. This is like Stuart Beattie's Heat, which is he had multiple versions that he got to work on throughout his career to really hone and shape it into something that becomes, because as we've talked to previous guests and when we've talked to anyone sort of within the industry who discuss, know about film, when we discuss Collateral, the thing they say constantly is Stuart Beattie's script is so flipping tight.
Oh, yeah, man. Oh, and this is the badge that he should wear proudly for the rest of his damn life, Collateral. Yeah. Obviously, you know, he's got a lot more than that, but yeah, seriously, man, amazing.
So I'm going to sort of today rip through the journey to screen a little bit, but knowing full well that we cover it in quite a lot of detail next week from the source themselves. And that way people can sort of really hear it from, I don't want this to be Jeff's internet research that's gone on for a few weeks. We get to ask all these things. Are they true? Did this happen? And it's and so good them, to hear honestly. It straight from them. Oh,
without does, without like he? Any it's PC so or any of that crap. Answers them honestly.
No, he does. So the film itself actually has origins a long way back to a 17-year-old Stuart Beattie who was taking a taxi for the first time in his life. And he had this little idea of, oh, man, you know, I'm having a great chat to this cabbie. This cab driver could have no idea what I've been up to before I've got into the cab. What if I was some crazy murderer just running around town and we're just having this chat as if nothing's going to happen? And he loves it. So he goes home and starts really putting this out and writes a 2-page treatment that he called The Last Domino. Now, that is something that he sits on for a little bit and then writes and writes and writes and expands on it. But basically, he's doing a bit of work over in the US, trying to get his he's doing some study over in the US, as well as doing a bit of screenwriting to try and hone his craft. He's previously done some work in Australia as well, but is waiting tables over there and sort of meets up with a friend who was where he was waiting tables and gets talking and sort of says, oh, I've got this script idea. It's called The Last Domino. What do you think? And she sort of goes, oh, let's pitch it to a few people. And again, Stuart elaborates on this far better than I'm doing it. So as I'm saying, I'm glossing over it. But so she has this chat and he ends up getting this opportunity to pitch this project and she loves it. The idea itself. And at the time, she was working for HBO doing some lower budget work. And basically, the project finds himself in a meeting where Stuart Beattie gets to pitch the idea to HBO and it gets picked up. At the time, HBO's got this low budget arm, which is being head up by Frank Darabont. Now, for those who don't know who Frank Darabont, he is the man who wrote and directed The Shawshank Redemption.
Still one of the best films ever made.
He wrote and directed The Green Mile, which is phenomenal. He's got another great film called The Majestic. He's been involved in a lot of screenwriting throughout his career on great films and later goes on to be the showrunner and really set the tone for what becomes The Walking Dead, which is that first season. He actually directs the first episode of The Walking Dead, which is an incredible pilot episode. So,
which is now like a zombie. It just won't fucking die. it's just hollow. It won't die.
Isn't this season the last season?
I think there's so many. There's Walking Dead World. Then there's like Walking Dead spin-offs. And oh my God.
Yeah, it's got those big dollars and they kill people off and bring people back.
Shit out of them.
It's pretty crazy.
I didn't know you could milk a zombie, but I guess you can.
So the project lands with Darabont and they start working on the idea as this sort of low-budget film for HBO. It's pretty exciting for Stuart Beattie because this is a project that he's sort of been working on for a lot of years now at this stage. So he starts developing it with HBO. And after a while, they do sort of 2 revisions of the script, 2 versions, and in the end, HBO just decide they're not going to move forward with the project. So a bit of heartbreak there. So Stuart goes back to working and he's doing a bit of work on other scripts, basically finds himself at a meeting with DreamWorks. Now, DreamWorks are really looking for projects at this point to start kickstarting this production company that they've got. And so he gets this meeting with DreamWorks and in that he mentions he's got this script and starts talking about what the concept is, the idea of a cab driver who's driving around not realizing at first that he's got a hitman in the back of his cab. And they're like, oh, this is great. Let's work on this. So he gets brought on to work on the project with DreamWorks. And again, you could imagine for Stuart Beattie, this is like, oh, it's happening. Yes, it's got a home. So great. So they're moving forward with this. And it's around this time they start doing a few revisions of the script, start thinking about the tone. We're sort of looking here, Craig, this is about the late 90s at this stage. And yep. The film starts moving its setting from, say, New York to LA. All those sorts of things start really shifting around about this time. And so in October 2000, Variety reports that director Mimi Leder is no longer directing Collateral. So at this stage, it's called Collateral. It's sort of, we're talking post-Insider as well here. Is when we're when we're talking, and the reason is that Leder had conflicts, budgeting conflicts with DreamWorks, as to
what has Mimi Leder directed.
Mimi Leder is actually, she had at this stage had directed TV shows and a few TV movies. In 97, had her film debut with The Peacemaker.
I fucking love The Peacemaker.
Yeah, so that's her first.
Watched the trailer again the other day. Oh, seriously, just the other day, like 2-3 days ago, and I watched the chase scene. Fantastic.
Well,
George Clooney, man.
Peacemaker comes out in 97. She follows it straight up with Deep Impact.
Yeah.
And then in 2000, Leder is actually coming off the back of Pay It Forward, which had got this sort of...
I love Pay It Forward.
Yeah, it had this sort of underground, almost cult following. And so Leder is actually someone that you'd go, oh, wow, I could see why they're speaking to this person. Very able to tackle character-driven stuff while also tackling the action and thriller. So Leder steps away. Now, also attached around this time was a Brazilian director called Fernando Morelias. Now, he'd actually directed City of God, which is the Brazilian film that is it's very well spoken about, very critically received. Would later go on to make The Constant Gardener as well. And more recent times, he also directed The Two Popes.
Hopkins.
Oh man, I'm having a blank too. It's not the one with
Jonathan Pryce.
Yeah, there you go. So
beautiful casting, man.
Beautiful.
They look so much alike. It's so good.
So Morelias talks about the fact that he had a discussion regarding the film and was really close to signing on for it, but then he realized that he'd have to relocate to LA for 8 months to film the film.
Oh, really?
So he decided that he just couldn't really bring it about. Now, an interesting little tidbit that I picked up in one of the interviews Morelias had was that this time his vision for the film was less of a thriller and more of a comedy.
It was called Dude in a Boot.
I feel like that should be set in Canada. what's really interesting in this is this is really crucial to this next little period for this film, which I'm starting to feel, and we sort of touch on it with Stuart, but it never really gets sort of locked down. But I think at this stage, the revisions that have been made at DreamWorks sees the film become more of a buddy cop film than it actually becomes. You know, you could imagine almost like, and when we hear casting next that became attached to the project, is you go, oh, I could see why this person that's chosen to play Max is selected. And I'm really happy that this was confirmed, this casting by Stuart in our interview. But basically, around this time, Russell Crowe is looking for a project. Now, Stuart's amazing and let us in on what project that was that he was working at. There was a Ridley Scott project, and you can hear more about that next week. But Russell Crowe was working on a project with Ridley Scott that fell apart at DreamWorks. So Russell Crowe suddenly finds himself with a period that he has got no work whatsoever on and looks for a project that can be his next film. That is Collateral. So Crowe is really interested to play the role of Vincent, and hired to play the role of Max was Adam Sandler. So this is why I'm saying that the comedy direction makes so much sense in the casting of Adam Sandler, because you have this goofball sort of dealing with these moments, and the body dropping on the cab, for instance, becomes a comedic moment not a moment of horror and shock as we see in the film that we get.
I thought Sandor was going to play it straight.
And this is something that Stuart does sort of confirm next week, is that Sandler wanted to play it straight. They'd had him at this point on board for the thriller. But, yeah, it just seems such an odd thing to have this comedy. But as you mentioned, Stuart does say in his interview with us that Sandler wanted to play this straight and really have this as a serious role as Max.
Man, that would have been crazy. Like, even as a jokey one, I could see how that can work.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, there's the psychopath and the, you know, the goofy cop.
Yeah.
You know, it would have been awesome if they did the, it would have been, I just, for some reason, all I can think of is when I think, when it's more funny buddy cop comedy, all I can think of is John Candy and Steve Martin. John Candy, back in New York, John Candy is the cabbie. And just Steve Martin as the killer. But I don't know how, you know, John Candy can run.
I want to see the flipped version, which is Steve Martin's the cab driver and Candy is the straight serial killer sitting in the background.
He can play scary, man. Candy can play scary. He was good in friggin' not scary. He was weird in JFK. It was good.
Yeah. I did find some...
I miss you, John.
You
I love
love
you, man.
Old, you love
I
John
fucking
Kenny,
love John
you?
Kenny, man. It actually makes me teary. Please don't talk about it. Hey, I'm that seriously, I don't. I love that man
I did
so much.
Find, Craig, a few interviews where Michael Mann talks about the script at this stage. And he actually talks about the role of Max was written as a Woody Allen-esque sort of character. It was very Jewish stereotyped and was a bit over the top. So he talks about the fact that it felt as though someone who had never been to New York had written this character.
That's so funny. I can just imagine it falling on a car. Oi!
Yeah. Now, what's really awesome is at this stage with Russell Crowe on board, he then takes the project to Michael Mann. And as we heard, this is sort of, you know, that post-Insider moving on to Lee Town for Michael Mann. So he takes the project to that. And after a few delays, as we mentioned, Crowe drops out. Now, Stuart has some really good anecdotes around the delays and things like that as well, which I loved. Mann also does a few, sits there and starts pulling it apart. He talks about how much he loves Stuart's script. He actually says that he loves the story structure. And so he saw that there was this beautiful piece of work sitting there, and he really loved the immediacy and the intensity around this is happening now. It's all going to take place in a span of a couple hours, and the film is really contained within this time period. And so he was really drawn to this. So Mann brings some notes, goes to Stuart and asks if they can do some rewrites. So they start working on the script a little bit more, obviously getting it to a place where Michael Mann's ready to work on it.
Yeah.
So then Mann, with Russell Crowe's dropping out of the project, they approach Tom Cruise and he comes on board in the role of Vincent.
Go, Tom.
Oh, no. And we've got to remember at this time in Cruise's career, he's not really riding a wave of success at the moment. He's seen as he's a little bit eccentric. And
he's a little bit.
Not really enjoyed by the public view. He takes a few big risks from sort of 99 onwards. You know, Magnolia was a massive risk for Cruise in his career. And again, we get to Collateral. And this is really, I loved how Lee described it in our Ali episode, that this is a real career-defining performance for Tom Cruise, because it showed that he doesn't have to be the hero.
No.
And he can still be the absolute scene stealer for the entire film.
But you still cheer for him.
It's crazy, isn't it? It's crazy.
Well, it's funny. It's just, and it's one of those things, I guess, you know, well, we can talk about it now, but it's, he's a character, he plays this character a lot. It's just this time he's on the different side of a very thin fence. And yeah. Fuck it. You know what I mean? Like, Like one of the, there's a fantastic scene where he goes, how long have I been, how long have you been doing this for? And he says, in the private sector. So obviously he started in the, he started working for the government. So he fucking, this yep. could be Ethan Hunt after about fucking 10 bad years, man, 10, 20 bad years. He's just fucking doing this right. It, this is what he does now. This is what he does.
Yeah. I love it.
This is his possible mission.
And I do. Do you know what? It's so funny you bring that up because I don't know if you noticed very early in the film is a little cameo from Jason Statham.
That was hilarious. I totally forgot about that.
He pops up for literally like 10 seconds, drops a case off. But have you heard the confirmed sort of fan theory around his role?
That he's the transporter?
Yeah. So,
oh, no, so, I just guessed that. No, so awesome, really?
The fan theory.
That's awesome. That makes so much sense.
Is Jason Statham's character in this role is the transporter, and in one of his missions, he's driven this package to drop off to Tom Cruise in the airport and moves on. And so yeah, they confirmed it a couple of years later that Jason Statham was playing that as the transporter.
Oh, that's fucking awesome. I didn't know that. Oh, I love this world.
So cool. So as we mentioned, Tom Cruise is on board and Adam Sandler's forced to leave due to scheduling conflicts. He had the film Spanglish coming up, another one where he's taking a very serious approach to acting. And so with that, they start looking for someone to work on the film and replace him in the role of Max. And Michael Mann approaches someone that he is now working for a third film in a row with in Jamie Foxx. Second JF. Film. He'll go on to work on a third film in
Jay Fox.
Miami Vice. Now, the casting gets rounded out with Jada Pinkett Smith, Javier Bardem, and Mark Ruffalo. Now, Mark Ruffalo's role was originally signed for Val Kilmer to be on the project, and he left pretty close to production starting to go off and make Alexander with Oliver Stone. So
he was good in that too.
Not a bad choice at all. Now, as always, Michael Mann ensures that his characters are well versed in who they're going to play. He ensures that there's some research done around all this. And so Michael Mann approaches firstly Tom Cruise and says, when you're doing this role, you need to be a hitman who can be invisible. So people aren't going to notice you in the streets. You need to be able to be in public and people not know it's Tom Cruise. So Tom Cruise goes off and actually works for a while for FedEx as a FedEx delivery driver to hone his ability to drop packages off without anyone noticing that it's actually Tom Cruise delivering these packages.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so he does that. And he also puts about 3 months work on Cruise to ensure that he could handle firearms in such a manner that he is basically a professional hitman himself. And you could see anytime Tom Cruise is holding a weapon, it's like, I'm going to just say something right now, Craig. I actually didn't realize how crucial collateral was for what we deem future action films, because the club scene where Tom Cruise is walking through just killing people as he's trying to get to Javier Bardem's character is, you may as well be watching John Wick.
It's, no, he's after the Asian dude.
Oh, the Asian guy. Yeah, sorry. In Club Fever. It's virtually a John Wick film. You could see Keanu Reeves playing that role and they flip it to make him the good guy.
It's that visceral, it's the visceral fight where you actually, they start to add more effects into the impacts. Yep. So you actually start to see more impact on what's actually happened. Like there's more of a crunch to each punch. And you know, there's a twist. You feel, you hear the twist. It's very, they boost up the sound. They make a lot more guttural now when it comes to those fights. Bourne. It's a very Bourne-ish type thing.
Yeah.
And the fight scenes are all, you know, they have that beautiful choreography that makes you go, oh wow, that's very, you know,
it's intense, but it's beautiful to watch, and Tom Cruise does it so darn well. It's just so good. So on top of that, Fox spends a few months learning the ropes from cabbies in LA. Jada Pinkett Smith spent some time with some attorneys in and out of courtrooms to really learn more the mannerisms of how a high-end defense lawyer will work as well. So with all their research, their training in place, they've got the cast ready, filming begins, and it takes place entirely at night in LA.
Dang.
And for those not aware, the night shoots are insanely grueling for a cast and crew. And Mann is not a quick, punchy director. He is very detailed. So this would be...
I'm sure LA is pretty fucked up at night as well.
Yeah, totally. And there are some scenes that were filmed where they went into really dodgy parts of LA to film. And I think there was one scene where they're filming in some of the streets and either side of the street were like rival gangs lived.
Awesome.
And even I heard the hotel room where the first person is killed by Tom Cruise, they literally went into that apartment, said, this is the perfect spot for us to film. It's got the alley. It's got all this stuff. And the only thing they put in there that wasn't already in the room was a big screen TV. Everything else was inside those apartments. You're literally looking in. Oh, my God,
the dude was a dirty fucker. That's awesome.
And so, so it takes place at night around LA. And as I mentioned, 80% was filmed using high definition digital cameras, which is do you know what? I thought I wouldn't enjoy the digital nature after that scene at the start of Ali. I thought I wasn't going to enjoy the look of Collateral.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know how that opening in Ali would work. You know, it was so digitized and sharp, but also grainy.
Like pixelated.
Yeah. I just thought, I don't know how this is going to work, but I'm so glad the technology obviously developed so much in 3 years that.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't have to use that weird glow around the face.
Yeah, totally. It almost feels like, I guess that opening of Ali feels somewhat like a reality television show. And I just didn't want that to happen. So predominantly there were a few sets. There were very minimal sets made, but predominantly this film was all done on location around LA. So,
You can see it too. It's fantastic.
It's so lived in. It's crazy, isn't it? So as usual, Michael Mann, he's quite demanding on set. And he's wanting perfection. He's wanting a vision to be realized. And unfortunately, it takes its toll. There's a few casualties along the way, as we're finding happens in quite a lot of his films, Craig. But cinematographer Paul Cameron is actually forced to leave after 3 weeks of filming. Oh. And so 3 weeks of night shoots too. So just... please remember. But basically, what I read that Michael Mann was really hoping in the look of the film was he really wanted this digital medium to reflect his screening room for the dailies he had set up. So the digital footage was graded and looked like it would if he was watching a 35mm print. So he was really specific in he wanted it to be lit in certain ways. He wanted it to be shot in different ways to almost mimic a 35mm film, which at this point, people weren't doing those things with digital. It was really...
And it'd be hard because you're on location.
That's exactly right. At night. It's not like you can trick it with daytime shoots, you know. So it takes its toll and Paul Cameron leaves after 3 weeks. He's released by a gentleman named Dion Beebe. Now, Beebe, I found a great article, which is really quite large, about the American Cinema Association. Chat to him, and he actually was asked later what the experience was like working with Michael Mann throughout the shoot. And I'd like to just share this because I think it's probably the best window into how Michael Mann works on set. So he says, Michael is an incredibly demanding director. He's very demanding of everyone, especially his camera crew, but it's inspiring to work with him because he has such a clear vision of what he wants and he'll pursue it without compromise. He adds with a chuckle, before I started working with him, he was described to me as a director who prepares like Rembrandt and executes like Picasso. I felt that was pretty insightful.
Man, that's hardcore. That's amazing to basically... it pretty much matches up with it. I like how he's all the PC way of saying he's an arsehole.
Well, it means that he's very detailed, but he is... The Picasso, I just picture these pieces that are just all over the shop and then they come together in the edit room and we have found that he loves to just spend a meticulous amount of time editing and shaping his film in post. So, Craig, the film, as I mentioned, is released. It's released on the... I've lost my date. Sorry, Craig. On the 6th of August.
Oh, jeez, Jeff, what you doing?
I know. Collateral was released 6th of August 2004 and was quite a financial success with $220 million. Positive reviews, positive box office, good budget return. So that's the film's journey to screen. Also, need to note, this is a film that Michael Mann has not made any director's cuts of.
Awesome.
So we're seeing his vision of the film there. So, Craig, I'd love to know, going into this film then, when was the last time you watched it?
I thought I owned it on Blu-ray, but I didn't.
Wow.
So we're going way back, when, man. I probably just, look, I remember leaving the theater, enjoying it, but disappointed because I didn't like, spoiler alert, I didn't see how Jamie Foxx could kill Tom Cruise. I'm a huge Tom Cruise fan, obviously. And so I was like, nah, that's bullshit. I wanted, in my world, Tom Cruise killed them all. Just fucking killed them all. And then went home and just spend his money, his drug money on whatever he wanted to on just, you know, drugs and bitches. But, and so I left. I remember leaving disappointed at the ending. And so, yeah, I'd been friggin' ages, man. Ages.
So
years.
Interesting.
Literally, possibly decades.
Do you know what's crazy?
A decade, at least.
Crazy, Craig, is I was in the same boat, so I do own it. And I know I've owned it on DVD, but...
Yeah, I've owned it on DVD. Because you and I bought fucking everything.
Yeah, we did for a season. Around this time, actually, I think we start becoming friends around this time, Craig. So, but I couldn't find it on my movie list, meaning that I've not watched it in 10 years.
Yeah.
Which, again, is crazy because I guess when we start this season, we talk about films like Heat and even to an extent Ali and The Insider and Collateral. And we say, oh, man, I love that film. I've watched it so many times. And then you realize you haven't watched it in quite a while.
Mm.
But that doesn't mean that you don't remember the film like it was you were watching it frequently.
I remember I enjoyed it. Like, it was just the ending turned me off. And then for some reason, it just fell away.
So interesting. So I guess, Craig, knowing the journey we've been on this season, what do you expect going into it?
Oh, I expected high quality. I was excited, obviously, coming through the past films. I was even happy to see Jamie Foxx because I thought he was great in Ali.
Yep.
So there was nothing really holding me back from it. You know what I mean? So yeah. I was, all excited.
I think for me, I was... really excited for this one, especially after we had our chat with Lee and Tim last week and they both confirmed my hopes, which is that I'm going to have this tight thriller. There's great chemistry between Cruise and Fox throughout the film. I had forgotten how incredible the cast was surrounding them.
Fucking so did I. Oh my God.
I literally was spending the whole movie, and I have watched it twice now because I enjoyed it so much. And can I say, the second time watching this film, there's probably about 10 days between watches of it. The second time watching this film did not bother me in the least. You know, sometimes we could watch a film for our season when we watch our first and last film and then we repeat our last film within a couple of days or a week of each other and that second watch can be a little bit of a slog because you're like, oh.
A bit arduous.
Yeah. not at all with Collateral. There was so many details within that film that I missed the first time around, or you almost have confirmed mentally. You know those moments in the film that you're like, oh, did that just happen? But it keeps moving at such a pace that you're just like, ah, it's okay. I'll just keep on the journey. It's fun, you know. But like watching it, I'm like, man, everyone in this film is bringing their A game. Little details like, you know, Jamie Foxx, when that first body hits the roof and his sandwich goes everywhere, like there are moments throughout the film where in his shock state, he's like, I got to clean the cab, like wanting to clean the interior of the cab. And the first time around, I wasn't as aware of it, but it's actually almost as if Jamie Foxx's character has OCD. And so it's so hard for him to function, not just because of the shock of, you know, lifting a dead body into the boot of his cab and having a dead body drop onto the roof of his cab, but to function mentally knowing how filthy the inside of his cab is.
It's his world.
Yeah.
It's his world. And you can see just like he's a man who's basically frightened about the rest of the world, and the cab is the only place that has control for him.
It's so good. And at the start of the film, there's that moment where he's sitting there trying to do the crossword while he waits for the cab to come in. And he's sitting in the company sort of car lot. And the moment that he shuts the door to his cab, all the sound just stops.
Stops. That's beautiful.
And it is, isn't it? There's like, and it's really interesting because it was one of those things I hadn't considered, is just how soundproof a car is.
It does, hey.
Yeah, it's incredible because I jumped in the car with Harrison yesterday and he's just loving to play with the steering wheel at the moment. And so I sat there and I just closed the door and I was like, wow, this is really quiet in here. It's so good. But again, like Mann uses sound design so well in his films that little moments like that, they're so effective. Like the diner scene in Heat, you know, where the sound of the ambient noise around them sort of fades out and then fades back in when the conversation's over. You know, it's so, this is like, it really is, it's such a well-made thriller because this so easily, and I don't want to bag out a film, but this so easily could have been a Peacemaker, you know, or a...
Hey, or Peacemaker is awesome.
Or a Proof of Life, or, you know, all those thrillers that were dropping around this time that are good, you know, they're good, but you don't watch it and go...
They're not really thrillers.
Well, you watch them...
They're action pieces. Like, if you... Yes. Like, Proof of Life and obviously, they're not really... They don't ratch up the tension for an extended level like a thriller should.
Yep.
And that's what's amazing about this film. It's, you're literally in the, figuratively, obviously, in the car with them.
Yeah. And it's so,
you know,
great.
You're confined in the car with them. And the fact that it's dark outside makes it feel even smaller inside the car. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Love it so much. And it's so beautifully shot inside that cab. Like the way that they capture, you know, again, like you can see the way that The Insider visually influences later work. So that close up on Jamie Foxx's face, still nice and clear, with in the background, you can see Cruz is looking at his notes while they're driving and still having conversations. But then even in the background, they've got the beautiful, like blurry sort of headlights just going off out the back windshield, you know, like it's so beautifully shot. And the way that Mann is able to use the city of LA as a character within the film, it's so darn good. Like, I'm so glad it's not New York, because I think LA has this, I love the books. They made a TV series on it later, which is the Harry Bosch books.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of the early books, they often talk about parts of LA where the wolves are still wild through the streets at night and stuff like that. And so, like, that, I guess for me, LA is that sort of city, you know, where you can have these beautiful buildings like we see in Heat overlooking the city up in the hills that are just expensive and gorgeous, and there can still be the wolves roaming the streets even though you're in the city. And
yeah, exactly.
I love that you can drive. One part of LA is gritty, ghetto based. There's gangs in there, really sort of dangerous. You can feel the tension and the danger in the location. Like that first hotel. Like that first hotel is just like, I don't know. It
feels like sometimes like you're actually playing like a Grand Theft Auto game.
It totally like, does.
Because each area has its distinct, you know, like a distinct feel.
Yeah.
And has this distinct, like, you know, culture,
yeah,
as well. You know what
so
I mean? Like
good.
Each witness he goes after, even when you go into, you go to the corporate side of LA,
yep.
It goes to the rich side of LA. You yep. know, with that guy who lives up in the mountains. You go to obviously the Mexican side of LA.
Yep.
You know, at all of these basically areas where you're just like, wow, man. It's such a melting pot.
Yes.
Yet the funny thing is it's never pictured as expansive. Like he never really pulls back for those big landscaping shots too often.
Yeah.
Because it's almost like you said, LA is a character, but it's also like LA is actually keeping Jamie Foxx's character in the cab as well. You know,
yes.
It's one of those things that are actually capturing him as well. It's amazing. I love it.
It's so good, isn't it? And like you have those moments that they're almost mirror images of each other. So, you know, the idea of Foxx is sitting behind in the alleyway waiting for Cruz. The next time they're sitting in an alleyway again, but this time he's tied to the steering wheel. And we have that moment where he's like honking the horn, trying to get people's attention. And lo and behold, the people that come down are a whole heap of sort of white supremacists who, you know, try to rob him. And it's like all these little moments that you're so concerned for Jamie Foxx, and he plays the character so darn well, Craig. Like,
seriously, this is probably my favorite Jamie Foxx role.
He's so great, isn't he?
Like, look, the thing about Ray is he plays Ray very similar to himself, you know what I mean? Like, you know, that brash type character, because that's who, you know, Ray Charles was at youth. Here, he plays totally against type.
He does.
And he does it well, man.
He does it well.
Like, don't get me wrong, you could always say there's other actors out there who could have done, but yeah, there could be. But man, Jamie Foxx, to his credit, plays this character perfectly.
Well, it's
I love it.
It's not just a downtrodden character, because, and this is, I think, if we were to compare, say, Sandler to Jamie Foxx. Now, later when we go off and watch Uncut Gems, Sandler has that menacing nature about him that sort of pops up. But in Collateral, I don't know if Sandler could have that moment, and someone would probably throw Punch Drunk Love in my face to say, watch that. But he could play the downtrodden side of the cabbie. But that moment where he has the conversation with Javier Bardem in the club, and it goes from being nervous to, I'm just going to own this moment and really show you. It's the moment where he says, can you tell that guy to put his gun away behind me? And then, and he goes, what did you say? And then you can see he takes the glasses off and he's like, tell the guy behind me to put the gun away, you know, and really.
Have you seen Punch Drunk Love?
Not in a very long time.
Do you remember? He plays a violent man, isn't it?
Yeah, see, it's been so long.
He plays a man who snaps, who like literally snaps. He could do it. I think there's also a dynamic, and it's, you know, call me friggin' whatever you want, but I think there's a dynamic in their color as well.
Yep.
And I think that plays into the role as well.
Oh, it's,
you know what I mean? It almost does try bring across as the buddy cop, but it doesn't actually, which is good, but they go in a total different direction. Because there's a part there where you almost go, oh, you know, it, you know, Fox and Cruise might even team up.
Definitely. But, well, there's a, the, what's incredible, and this is where Cruise is incredible for his role as Vincent, is that in the film, you actually believe that Cruise cares for Max. You know, like you, you the character of Vincent, it's almost like there's that moment towards the end of Fight Club where Brad Pitt's character goes into the convenience store. He sticks a gun to the guy's head and says, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And basically puts him through the ringer. And you find out at the end of the film, he's got all these licenses on the back of his door. And he regularly checks up to make sure these people are actually following their dreams. And in a way, the anarchy that surrounds Tyler Durden surrounds Vincent, because he's a killer. But he wants people to not be the weaker versions of themselves. Like even the first moment that Vincent approaches the cab, he actually, his demeanor in that is really dismissive of Jamie Foxx. And it's almost like, it's almost like he's testing Foxx out to see, is this someone that I can, if I have him hired for a night, can make, do the job I need done. As opposed to someone who's going to put up a fight the moment that he realizes that Vincent is a bad guy. You know, and Cruise brings such presence to this role that it's seriously like, I just can't believe how great both lead actors are in this film.
Yeah, that's what I was, and once again, to Jamie Foxx's credit, he holds his own with, you know, obviously Tom Cruise in my mind is better and will always be better.
Yeah.
But he holds his own. He does really well because Cruise is, like I said, Cruise is still playing the same role. He's just a villain, man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And he's dark, but he's also, you know, there's parts of him that you just go, yeah, that's Tom Cruise, man. He's sticking up for you.
Yeah.
You know, he's doing awesome. Good. But then it's just, you know, there's parts where he talks about, you know, when they're talking about their dads or they're talking about their upbringings and he's asking why he kills and all this type of stuff. And they're fantastic conversations. I love those conversations, you know, and he talks about how his dad died and all that type of stuff. And you just want to know more about Vincent.
You do. You do, don't you, Craig? It's so darn good. And I got to say, that's credit to the writing of this film. You know?
Oh, it is. That fantastically credited to the writing. Like, I love most scenes, like and I even talk about later about the jazz scene.
Oh, yes.
But the acting in that scene is fantastic.
Yeah.
Like where you actually see it hurts Tom Cruise, who's a character, Vincent, who's a jazz fan, to kill a jazz master.
Yeah.
And you actually see him touch him, you know, and you see an actual empathy cross his face.
Yeah.
Like beautifully cross his face after fantastic dialogue by Stuart Beattie. Yeah. And then you just see Cruise just put that, you know, across. Seriously, there's one of my favorite scenes, man, in a long time. And I can't believe I forgot it.
And in that, Jamie Foxx as well is sitting there and you see his thoughts about Tom Cruise's character completely shift. You can see him coming around being, oh, wow, he's actually not too bad. He knows heaps about this stuff. Oh, man, what a good guy this guy could be. And then kablang, it's like done and out they go. And the complete shock of how like visceral and a response that was, the way that he was able to shift from charming and personable to cold killer, is just like, it's so well done. Also, we got to say, I think the other scene is the Javier Bardem scene with Jamie Foxx. Like, it is so darn good in that club.
Javier Bardem is so menacing when he's telling a story about fucking Santa. You're just like, oh my lord, man. I'm sketchy of this dude.
I love it, Craig. He really is. He's so darn good in this. And it's one of those things, we talk about it next week, but this is a cast who, like, post our interview with Stuart Beattie, I was thinking back and I'm like, you know, you've got Mark Ruffalo and Peter Berg playing the cops investigating the killings and the taxi. And Peter Berg was probably the biggest actor aside from Tom Cruise and Jamie Foxx in the film at that time.
Yeah, yeah, hey.
And so, you know, and I'd love to know, I probably should do a bit of research, but I think around this time Peter Berg is being mentored by Michael Mann. He goes on to, Mann produces the Hancock film Will Smith was in.
Yep.
And I think...
And that, what's that, The Kingdom? With Jamie
the
Fox?
Kingdom, yep. Jamie Foxx is in that one that Peter Berg directed as well. So I think there's some connections there. But Mark Ruffalo was essentially an unknown actor at this time.
Yeah. And yeah, and it would still be an unknown actor for a, you know, really became a character actor for a long time.
Yeah, and a great character actor because...
Oh, yeah, he's an amazing actor.
When I saw him, I'm like, far out, Mark Ruffalo could... totally be in like a Training Day or a Harsh Times.
Oh man, Mark Ruffalo Chicano, eh?
Yeah, totally.
I loved it.
I was so shocked by that. Hey, it was so darn good. I just kept spending the whole film being like, Jason Statham? Mark Ruffalo? Javier Bardem?
I was even impressed with Jada Pinkett, man. I'm never really impressed with her.
Yeah.
She always crosses me as she plays the role she's got, but I've never seen her and go, yeah, someone else could have done her role better.
Yeah.
In this film, though, she plays it really well. Like, you could tell she picks up the mannerisms of a person who basically works long hours.
Yeah.
But also is a very strong personality. Like, I love her story about how she prepares for the next day in a courtroom. And, you know, well written once again by Stuart Beattie, beautifully written. But she does this well. Once again, this is my favorite Jada Pinkett role.
She is so good in this film. And even the moment at the end where Jamie Foxx has got the cell phone, he's trying to contact to warn her about the fact that I love the way it's really cleverly done. The card handed to Jamie Foxx with their interaction initially. You sit there and go, oh, wow. You know, there's hope for romance for this hardworking cabbie. There's hope for a life outside of this. You know, you're already feeling, oh, I want better for him than this life he's got. And it doesn't necessarily go down that road. It's used as such a great plot device because then he later finds out, like that, it shocked me, like it threw me when you find out, oh, wow, it's going to be Jada Pinkett Smith. And again, Tom Cruise comes out of her building at the start of that film.
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly. He's been casing the joint.
Yeah, totally. So he's already seen that she's working. And, you know, again, one of those things I didn't pick up as great in the first watch. The second time around, I'm like, oh, my gosh, he's in there already making sure he knows where things are. He comes out of the stairwell. You know,
one of the crazy things I picked up in this film, how much Jamie Foxx lies to his mum. He literally fucking gets pictures of celebrities and signs it.
Yep.
And she puts it in the back of her, she puts it in around her bed.
Yep.
Because he's saying that he's been transporting celebrities all around the town.
Yeah, he works on that backstory, doesn't he?
Oh man, that's a lot of effort in that fucking backstory, man, if you're signing signatures and shit.
Yeah, or getting them sourced so they're the real signature. But again,
that's what I love about Vincent. Vincent calls his bullshit.
He does.
But in saying that, Jamie Foxx calls his bullshit as well.
He does.
That's what's good about the film is they're very much harsh mirrors to each other.
Yeah, I likened it to magnets. They're like magnets who oppose but are still drawn to each other. It's this weird sort of, it's so great, isn't it?
Mm.
Oh, I love it. And I love the way that this, it really is. We're back after Ali. We're back with a really solid character study. Like you could literally, we're spending the majority of this time talking about how much we love the characters of Vincent and Max. And the way that they interact together, the way that they oppose each other. And it's 100% proof of what really drives a Michael Mann film, isn't it? You know, like he wants those rich characters.
Exactly. When he keeps it constrained.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like when he focuses on it, like Ali was a little bit, got out of hand. Once again, that's like we've said, ad nauseum, it's a fucking big character.
Yeah.
And it's not a character of his own making. But this one here, you can just tell he's thriving in this atmosphere, in this script. He's just thriving in this Stuart Beattie script.
I think also, like, we've talked about it in previous seasons as well. Zack Snyder was a great example. I think we might have mentioned it with Lee and Tim as well, is the fact that when you give someone a monstrous budget, to which Ali had something like $165 million budget, you know, which is incredible. That's an incredible budget. To, like, more than halve that is really important, because suddenly man is forced to think outside the box on how he'll do some things. You know, again, those constraints bring creativity, and what you end up with is a tighter feeling film, because we need the claustrophobia in this film. Like, you can't imagine.
Those constraints bring thrillers.
Oh, don't they?
They're what makes thrillers.
And
you can't have a big budget thriller.
And I guess I couldn't remember back those years ago when I watched this film how there are Hitchcockian moments throughout it. You know, like it throws you for a loop here, and then suddenly you're back, and just when you think that he's out, he's pulled back in. You know, it's so well done.
Yeah. Oh man, seriously, it's a film that I'm so upset with myself that I let it fall off the radar.
Yeah.
Like, this genuinely is a fantastic friggin' film, and I absolutely love it.
Yeah.
And I was so surprised that why isn't this been on rotation more for me? You know what I mean? Like, what's the go here? You know, it's got Tom Cruise in it. You know, friggin' hell. Did I really let my petty hate of Jamie Foxx ruin this fucking film?
Yeah.
And it is. It's fantastic, man. It is fantastic.
I think it really is. And when we get to ranking a bit later on, Craig, it's going to be very interesting, because let's be honest, if this was a director other than Michael Mann's film, let's go to Joe Carnahan, right? If Joe Carnahan dropped Collateral in his filmography as well as The Grey, then suddenly we have a director, throw Narc in the mix as well. You know, like, you have a great director in there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And unfortunately for Joe Carnahan, we get Stretch, which is literally the Javier Bardem club scene is mirrored in a goofy way in Stretch with James Badge Dale. And Stretch is literally just it really hurts me to say it, because I love Joe Carnahan so much, but after watching this film, Stretch is like the 80s Meatballs version of Collateral. But
it's what you think the buddy cop would have looked like.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? It's so strange. Yeah. That's so true, Craig. And so it's really sad, actually, because this film, unfortunately, has probably tarnished Joe Carnahan a little for me, because I'm seeing how well made a film like this can be done with someone who really knows their craft.
Well, with the difference between, I guess, Joe Carnahan and Michael Mann is, with Joe Carnahan, you can almost see what he was going for.
Yeah.
With Michael Mann, he does it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and you're actually, with Michael Mann, you're like, mate, yeah, I can see you. You're almost there. I can see your whole picture, you know. But Michael Mann, just like, yeah, that's it. That's what you're going for. That is what you're going for.
And I think also Mann he nails the details. And so things like, you know, like the sandwich in the car being an important part of why Jamie Foxx isn't coping, you know, an attributing factor into that. I think the one moment that is so huge is that moment in the jazz club where he finally kills the jazz club owner. He walks straight over and holds his wrist. like Tom Cruise does. And it's weird. At first glance, it looks as though he's trying to make sure that he's safely put down on the table as a sign of respect. And I realized the second time around, it's actually not. Tom Cruise is ensuring that he knows he's dead. He sits there and holds his pulse.
He's setting up his body so it looks like he's just fallen asleep on the table and no one will bother him.
It's so good, isn't it? And it's not played out in a way to go, hey, watch me do this. Watch what I'm doing. It's really intelligent. It's like done so quickly, so efficiently, and then out the club they go.
I think it shows you the thin line between a good director and a great one.
Oh, man.
You know what I mean? And it is it is his meticulous nature that draws you in more and therefore you enjoy the film more.
Oh, so much more, Craig. So much. I think Collateral for most directors, if this was the best film in their filmography, it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, but lucky for us, Michael Mann has also got films like The Insider, Last of the Mohicans. He's got Heat in there. They're like, great films, aren't they, Craig? It's just
Man, seriously, amazing.
So, Craig, we've probably had a decent chat around this film. You got anything else you want to throw in before we wrap things up?
No, pretty good. Cool. Pretty good. So, can't wait for you guys to hear the Stuart Beattie stuff.
Yeah, me either. There's heaps more chats around this stuff. So, Craig, overall, what are your thoughts on Collateral?
No, man, overall, angry at myself for such a damn good movie.
It's so true, Craig. I think it's got a great cast, incredible acting, intensely tight film that is really creative and innovative filmmaking within this genre. Yeah. And so I think this is probably a film that I will watch more frequently. This is probably every season we have one film that's not the best film, but we know that we're going to love forever. You know, we talk about Flight from Robert Zemeckis, a stack, and Contact as well. And they may not be his best work, but they're the films that I know that I will happily go watch in a heartbeat. And I think for me, this will be my Michael Mann film. This is one that I will happily throw on, get transported with Jason Statham, and just love the heck out of it for the entire time that I watch it. It's so freaking good, hey.
Definitely, definitely.
So, Craig, I'd love to know. We're going to move on to the Cinefool Studio whiteboard and really start tackling the ranking of this film. So for Craig Killian, we have at number one, Heat, number two, The Insider, number three, Last of the Mohicans, followed by Ali at number four, Manhunter at five, The Keep at six, Thief at seven. Where would you put the good old Collateral, Craig?
Oh. So what are my first two again?
Heat, The Insider, followed by Last of the Mohicans, and Ali is the top four.
Oh, actually, I loved it. Man, seriously, you know, I might put it in second. Oh, nah, the acting's better in The Insider. Put it in third. Put it in third, mate.
Love it. So good, Craig. Well, for me, I've got The Insider at number one. I got Heat at number two. Ali at number three. Last of the Mohicans at four. Thief at five. Number six, Manhunter, and seven, I have The Keep. I reckon I'm going to agree with you this week, Craig. It's awesome. Do you know what? I was really close to putting this higher. And I think if I hadn't put The Insider at number one, I probably would put this above The Insider. But I don't know if this is a better film than Heat. And I know the acting in The Insider is way better than the acting and storytelling in Heat. So it's so hard. But I think if there is a film that shows that Michael Mann still got it, if we were a bit worried after Ali, Collateral's the film that shows he's definitely still got it.
Yeah, definitely.
And it probably makes me a bit excited for next week's film because we're going to be tackling Miami Vice in our next episode.
Yeah, I'm excited to see Jamie Foxx, man.
Yeah.
It has made me a little bit more excited about next week.
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, next week we're going to talk Stuart Beattie. That's my fault. But we're going to have the week after the next film we talk about is Miami Vice.
Oh, sorry, yes. Next film.
Just
next
to not confuse people. Film. It's my fault, Craig. I led with it. But, yeah, so Collateral is going to be at number three for me as well. Craig and I keeping it together. I like it. We're pretty in sync with these things, aren't we?
Keeping it real.
I have had this crazy thought lately, Craig, which is for future seasons, we might make it that we have to agree where it's positioned. So the leaderboard is actually you and I deciding where it deserves to be. I think that might bring some fun chats. But we'll talk about
that. We should actually, maybe we should agree if we ever do a roundup of all the directors we need to agree with.
Oh, I love it, Craig. I love it. We'll do.
And just have an episode of us arguing.
Over directors.
Yeah.
Well, the Catherine Bigelow, Sam Raimi chat was pretty huge last season, so.
It'd be good. And yeah, we'd be able to use everyone's comments and stuff like that and opinions in it. It'd be good.
It'd be so good. I love it. So, Craig.
Online board meeting.
Where can people find us?
Oh, guys, go onto Twitter. Go on to Instagram at FFTL Podcast, or go on to Facebook from First to Last Podcast. Get on our page, you know, do some commenting on there as well. You can email us at info@fftlpodcast.com or just go to our page, www.fftlpodcast.com.
Love it. As always, please subscribe, share us with a mate, give us a review. We actually got a lovely review this week. I was really stoked about that one. So thank you to those people that gave us a delightful five-star review. I'll send you a link, Craig. You'll love it. You will love
it. It's not Jay Killian, is it?
No, it's not.
It's not a little Filipino lady who can't spell and has broken English and it goes, you know, I love my son. I mean, podcaster.
No, it's not. Okay, but it does say my little baby at the top. So
call me baby, everyone. As long as you give us 5 stars, don't care what the fuck you call me.
It's so good. As always, please share us around. We just want people to hear and be part of the fun that we're doing here. And please drink that Glee coffee, that sweet, sweet Glee coffee. Use the code.
Sweet, sweet Glee.
That's right. FFTL at the checkout. You're going to get 15% off, free shipping Australia-wide. Get on it.
Get that coffee in here, guys.
I am loving it.
Australia needs to wake up.
100%. And what better way to do it than with some coffee.
How do you brew?
How do you brew indeed?
How do you brew? Do you brew the thing that you do? No one I know can't ever brew like you do. Look at that.
You wrote a jingle. I love it. Great job, Craig.
I jingled it, man.
We'll use that for future ads. So good. So as we mentioned, next week we're going to drop our full interview with Stuart Beattie. I think it's a little over an hour's worth of great content in there. And I can tell you that we're ranging from chats around Pirates of the Caribbean. We'll talk 3:10 to Yuma. We'll talk Collateral. We'll talk Halo.
Screenwriting.
We'll talk screenwriting. We'll talk the way Stuart has mentored through the Australian film industry. We'll also get a hot tip on a new project that Stuart Beattie is working on.
Whoo!
Featuring a classic Australian novel. Ooh,
World
tease,
Boy 4.
Tease, tease. Woo. So check that out. And then the week after, we will be talking Miami Vice. So from all of us here at From First to Last Podcast, I'm Jeff Reed.
I'm Craig Killian.
And we'll catch you next week.